evening. First, I want to wish everybody a happy new year. I know it's been a few weeks now into 2026, but we didn't have a meeting last month because of the holidays. And I just hope that everybody had a chance to, spend some time with family and rest and really just kind of enjoy the holiday season. So I hope everybody's having a good start to the new year. I'm hoping that everybody received my email last week. There's going to be a change to the format of these monthly calls. Really, the purpose of these calls is intended to be, an exchange of information, and to share ideas, to share thoughts, really to be able to learn from one another. But it doesn't really seem like there's been much interaction amongst a lot of our clinical staff. And so what we're going to be doing is changing it such that we're going to have a presenter for each meeting. We'll have one for the earlier session and one for this session, where the topic of choice will either be, an interesting patient, perhaps a challenging patient that you've been treating, or perhaps an article review. But really, the purpose is to get better engagement and discussion, and to kind of teach each other and learn from each other from experiences. And so that is part of the reason why we'll also now be scheduling the meetings a month in advance, so people have a chance to check their schedules and make sure that they're available. I always prefer volunteers rather than having to assign somebody. We do have one volunteer already for next month's call, but we are still in need for another person. As always, you're more than welcome to join both calls. Again, because the presentations will be different, that'll give you that just mo that many more opportunities to chat and learn. But I just wanted to mention that. If you require any more details, I did include that in my email. Hopefully everybody got that. If you didn't get that, please let me know. So any questions about that so far? All right, the next agenda item I wanted to discuss was 2 weeks ago we had our annual conclave. This is a administrative meeting that we tend to have on an annual basis. This year was a little bit later than other years, but one of the things that's was brought up is the topic of skin sweeps, and this is something that will continue if it is requested from the facility standpoint. The company stance, the practice stance will be to not perhaps emphasize this as much as we have in the past. But if the facilities are requesting it or requiring it, certainly we'll continue to offer that service. But that is something that some of you may see as a change involving your buildings, regarding that service. Milt, I don't know if there's anything else that you'd like to add to that, but I'll certainly open the floor if anybody has any questions about skin sweeps.
No, I think you pretty much nailed it. I mean, there are some facilities that require it or request it, and we will continue to honor that, but we're not just going to be pushing it like we did, sometimes in the past. We've got to focus more on the regular appointments more than on skin sweeps. The skin sweeps are really meant just to provide facilities with a skin integrity reporting prior to potential surveys. And some facilities, are very diligent about wanting that, and some less so. And so those that want it, again, will honor it. Those that really could care less, we're not going to necessarily promote it.
All right, thank you, Milt. Any questions about About skin sweeps. The last thing I want to mention tonight is a little bit about the management of necrotic tissue. It has become apparent that there are some of our clinical staff that err on the side of not performing debridements. And this is something that, practice-wide, we're going to be looking at, more and more in detail. But there tends to be a preference to use agents like Santyl and things like that in the treatment of necrotic tissue. Where this can be problematic is a couple of reasons. Number one, prompt eradication or removal of the necrotic tissue is more beneficial in terms of minimizing risk for infection. So the longer that necrotic tissue is sitting around, the higher the chance there is for infection. But it also comes, to a facility satisfaction standpoint as well. First of all, agents like Santyl are not inexpensive, but there is also a delay with healing when that necrotic tissue is not removed. There are individuals in our practice that tend to kind of not perform these debridements if it is a concern for, technical skills and those types of things. We do have resources and things like that we can offer to help those individuals become more comfortable with the procedural aspect of debridements. So please feel free to reach out to myself or the education team. But we're here to help you from that standpoint. Understanding that yes, there will always be circumstances where debridement may not be the ideal first choice. Whether that's a patient that may be on, full anticoagulation. It's difficult to, get in touch with their POA for consent. Those circumstances are understood, and that's at your discretion. I do feel though that if those are the situations that would, it would be best to document those details in the note as well as to why, you're erring on the side of not doing a debridement versus doing it. Again, the ultimate clinical decision is left up to you, but again, understand that there are significant indications and reasons why debridement should be done, to accelerate the healing process, to minimize, risk for infection. If you're not going to be doing that, then, there should be documentation as to why not. Like I said, we'll be looking in more detail at everybody's data and looking to see if our patients really are getting their best treatments. But again, if there are concerns or reservations about performing sharp debridement, please let us know so that we can help fill that void. Any questions about that? All right. If there aren't any questions, then Milt, I'll turn it over to you if you have any additional comments.
As far as debridements and other procedures, a number of our facility clients are looking to us to perform those when appropriate. And some of them actually base quality measures and other types of reporting based on, how companies like us perform procedures at their facilities. They look at this as not a passive type of specialty, but one that they would like to see some assertiveness in making sure that we're managing, assessing, healing, and treating and healing wounds. And some of the chief clinical officers have periodically reached out and questioned why some of our providers seem reluctant to perform debridements. And we've actually had some terminations, candidly, over the last few years over this issue, when we have providers that seem to be overly reluctant. You know, there are some national types of standards that we're on the very low end of that scale on in performing them. And so, which is why we've had some chief clinical officers reach out to us. And in fact, as we try to gain some clients, some want to know what is our debridement rate, things like that. So it's really important to evaluate. It's not the be all and end all for every situation, obviously. And as I said in the prior call, I'm not a clinician and I'm not here to advise you when to do that. You have a excellent clinical team that you can reach out to and discuss that with. And if you need more education on that, you know, they're happy to do that. Dr. Karamati is available to be consulted on that. But, you know, we looked at some statistics internally on that, and we have some tremendous variability in that. And I can give you, like, just, I'm not going to name any names, but, you know, to give you some measure of, you know, how wide-ranging our results are in this regard, I'll give you one provider as an example, who in October had 68 encounters, performed 133 debridements. November, 397 encounters, 158. December, 431, 189. I'll contrast that with another provider, same 3 months, 326 encounters, zero debridements. 413 encounters in November, zero debridements. 590 encounters in December, zero debridements. You know, statistically, that's not something that should occur on the latter one in particular. That type of range, it doesn't seem statistically like it should, you know, fall in that kind of a range of 0, 0, 0 with that volume of encounters. So it is important to consider those as an appropriate measure, and particularly those that are surgical versus using Santyl. I mean, it's appropriate at times, obviously, but Santyl costs the facilities money, whereas the other doesn't. But it does ultimately impact facility quality measures, and it does impact ultimately, obviously, how they fare reimbursement-wise based on things like that, not just that, but in overall, you know, how care is provided. And there is an expectation that we will perform procedures when they are appropriate and not, as it's been described to me, nurse this along, because they say they've got nurses to do that themselves. They don't need our providers doing the same. They're looking to our providers for appropriate interventions when they are necessary or indicated. So that's what I wanted, you know, to bring up in that regard. I'm going to add another thing has nothing to, well, in a sense it does, but in a peripheral sense, and that is I sent out an email a few months ago about the change, as you've all heard, probably, that the reimbursement for biologics have considerably been reduced. That's still subject to whether that's going to come back or some modified amount, because there's some feeling that there was an overreaction. But I sent something out that because of that change, we had to change what we reimbursed for, because in some cases we would have lost money and subsidized the performance of applying tissue. But that said, when it's appropriate, we've had actual testimonials from patient families. I cited at the last call, one family reached out and sent a letter in about one of our New York providers who they said his performing providing tissue to help heal certain wounds literally saved their family member's life. It was a case, I think the patient had 3 or 4 stage 4 pressure injuries, and they got healed out, believe it or not. The main reason for that was ultimately amniotic tissue being applied. We've had other testimonials, not necessarily to that extent, but similar positive results. And again, it's not the silver bullet to solve every situation, but at times it is appropriate. So irregardless of what that reimbursement is, you should not change because reimbursement's been cut back, not providing amniotic tissue, because it has been proven to be successful in helping heal wounds in the right situations. And when you go from, let's say, at one point doing a lot of that and then dropping off completely, you actually paint the target on your back, not the other way around, because then they look at it as it was all about the money and not about really healing. So we have selected certain manufacturers and distributors because we feel they're ethical and appropriate and they don't overly push or whatever. And, they provide education and guidance, and that's why we stick with them and like, how they work with us. But one of the main things that they do for us is they assist and facilitate the IVR process in order to get approved to even order any tissue. We go through this IVR process, and they're on the hook also, if you will, in that regard, because if we don't get the IVR approved, we don't order from them. We don't get paid. They don't get paid. Ultimately, your submissions are not the be-all and end-all, but we can't begin the process if you don't have submissions. So it is carefully reviewed, scrutinized, and more often than not, even though you may have ordered a number of them, probably the higher percentage will be rejected simply because payers don't want to pay. If they don't feel it's absolutely necessary. But if it does, then it is deemed to be an appropriate approach. But again, it's not the be-all and end-all, and we don't want it just ordered for the sake of ordering it. And if it's not healing, then we stop. And wound education pays attention to that and will advise if they're seeing that there is no improvement. So keep that in mind. That's all I've got to say about all of that.
All right. Thank you, Milt. Open the floor up to anybody that has any questions about that? All right. It doesn't sound like there's any questions. So, Melissa, I will turn the floor over to you.
Oh, good evening, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I have a few topics that I need to cover this evening. The first being infection control. We've had some recent feedback from facilities about, proper hand hygiene, whether that's washing your hands, using, a hand sanitizer, but that needs to occur, after you take your gloves off, in between patients, any kind of soilage for whatever reason, but make sure you're using proper hand hygiene. And then enhanced barrier precautions. Make sure you're using PPE with, the proper needed necessary PPE for the enhanced barrier precautions at the buildings. I have received feedback that that's not always available. If that is the case, please reach out to your regional manager or myself so we can contact, perhaps the regional nurse or, the CNO and get those items readily available for you. Just a review of abuse and neglect, that is a reportable offense in long-term care. So if you see, observe any abuse, neglect, misappropriation, you must report it immediately to the DON or the administrator. Proper classification of wounds. Again, this has been a hot topic over the last couple months with, facilities, wanting to make sure that we're really reviewing each patient chart. For proper diagnoses, not everything on the foot is going to be pressure. It can be diabetic based on a diagnosis. It could be arterial if they have PAD, PVD. If it's on a lower extremity, they may have venous disease. So take all of those, diagnoses into consideration when you are classifying wounds. Addressing same stables and declines, that used to be an FYI on your audit. Now it's an audit item that must be addressed on, on that data service or when you receive your audit. And then the addendums need to be provided to the facility. MIPS 25, 20, 2025 and 2026. 2025 is coming to a close. We're gathering the last bits of information that we need. So you may still hear, or get inquiries from us regarding 2025. 2026 is live, so please complete all of your patient visits with the needed information. That's still CAD, which are the anticoagulants, antiplatelets, ACEs and ARBs, social drivers, advanced care plan, and then your dementias. None of that's changed from 2025. We're continuing with the same measures. And we'll complete our final submission for 2025 in March. So we'll have results and then we will let everybody know how we do. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you very much, Melissa. Again,
Oh,
I'll open the floor.
I'm Dr. Karamadi, I'm sorry, I forgot again. I just wanted to let everybody know that if you want to contact me and set up some time to talk about optimizing your notes so you're billing at the highest level possible for the services that you're rendering, please do so. You can, email me and we can coordinate a time to have that meeting. Now that's all I'm done, Dr. Karamadi.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Melissa. Again, I'll open the floor to anybody that may have any questions, comments, concerns, about anything discussed this evening. Right. I guess if nobody has any questions, again, I'll remind everybody that we're going to start the new format next month. Again, always welcome volunteers. If not, I will assign somebody. We do have one person who has already stated that they will present, but we will need another one. Again, if anybody's interested in being one of the first presenters, February 16th is our meeting for next month. So please reach out to me. Otherwise, thank you all for joining us this evening and look forward to speaking to you next month. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
All right.